Whereas philosophy is certainly not self-expression. And philosophy, of course, is argument. And you can say, well, is the conclusion true or is the argument valid?
Welcome to Season 3 of Five Questions, the podcast where we don't ask if the conclusion's true or the argument valid, but what they say about you. I'm your host, Kieran Setia. In each episode, I ask a philosopher five questions about themselves. There are two ground rules. One is that follow-up questions are allowed. The other is that the question I'm about to ask doesn't count as one of the five. So could you introduce yourself, tell us a bit about who you are and what kind of philosophical work you do?
Yes, thank you, Kieran, and thank you for inviting me on the podcast. I'm Ursula Coop. I'm Professor of Ancient Philosophy at Oxford University, and I study mainly ancient Greek philosophy. Topics I've been interested in have been philosophy of action, metaphysics, and ethics, and in a way, the intersections between those fields. In my early work, I focused mainly on Aristotle, and wrote about his account of time and change and action. But more recently, I've turned to some much later ancient philosophers, the Neoplatonists, and I've written a book on some of the things they said about freedom and about responsibility.
Well, I can't resist asking this question, given that you've thought about Neoplatonism, freedom and responsibility, and Murdoch is herself a kind of Neoplatonist, Wittgensteinian Platonist, she called herself, interested in freedom and responsibility. Do you have a view about Murdoch, either about her own work, if you've thought about it, or about her book about Plato, The Fire and the Sun, which I must admit is the one Murdoch book that I find impossible to read. It's so difficult.
Unfortunately, I've pretty much found Murdoch's philosophy something that I can't get into. So I haven't really read Murdoch carefully enough to have a view. I like her novels, but I don't really have a view about Murdoch's philosophy, apart from that I've never found I can really get on with it.
Do you have a favourite Murdoch novel?
The Black Prince, I remember liking very much.
We just had a reading group at MIT on The Black Prince, in which we read it, and I think overall people liked it, but boy, does she have a line in really unlikable narrators. I mean, oh
yes.
Man. Well, we've been talking about Murdoch already, and she is the inspiration for the podcast, and she begins it by telling us that philosophy is not self-expression, drawing this bright line between her philosophical work and her novels. And yet she also wrote, to do philosophy is to explore one's temperament, and yet at the same time to attempt to discover the truth. So does your temperament influence your philosophical work? And if so, how?
So I think my temperament does influence my philosophical work in some ways that I can identify. Although I have to say, I don't really think that my philosophical work is exploring my temperament. It might be exacerbating certain aspects of my temperament.
Uh-huh.
So the bit of my temperament that I thought was relevant is I think I have a tendency when making a claim to almost immediately qualify it or think of what the alternative point of view would be of somebody who might disagree with that claim and then sort of think, oh, well, but on the other hand, such and such. And I think that influences the way I do philosophy. And I think it's the reason I think it's a sort of general part of my temperament, not just an aspect of the way I do philosophy, is that I think it comes out in other ways in my ordinary life. An obvious example is a typical way that conversations with my husband go is I say something, he agrees with it, and then I say, oh, but on the other hand, or oh, but I think such and such. And that drives him crazy because he finds it really annoying that he says, I've just agreed with you and now you're objecting to this thing that I thought I was agreeing with you on. And I think that is just because that's my next move after I've said something is to think, oh, but on the other hand, or oh, but on the contrary, or perhaps we should instead say this. I suspect that makes a difference to both the way that I approach my own working out philosophical arguments. I suspect it also is partly why I'm attracted to history of philosophy, in that that involves, in a way, getting yourself into somebody else's way of thinking. I think it's useful for teaching in the sense that it helps if you're trying to think how somebody else's project might be developed, say a graduate student's project might be developed, if you can, as it were, throw yourself into their way of doing something. But I suspect it also has some disadvantages in terms of trying to construct an argument of one's own.
I'm interested, you say that that led you towards history of philosophy. Is it that thinking about someone else's ideas liberates you from the second guessing? Or is it that second guessing in this way is a valuable tool in exploring a historical figure's philosophical system?
I think it's a bit of both. So I find myself more attracted to philosophers who are saying things that are weird or different from how we would think of things when I'm doing history of philosophy. I mean, I know some people think of Aristotle as being very down to earth, but actually the things in Aristotle I'm interested in are pretty weird things that he says. So I think I kind of like just putting myself into that other way of thinking about things. And I sort of enjoy doing that. And I think it's also more possible for me to turn off the second guessing or to suspend it a bit when I'm thinking about how one might develop somebody else's view than when I'm thinking about how to develop something that I'm asserting in my own right.
Does it make it hard to write? I mean, do you find when you're writing that you're second guessing your own way of putting things or your own formulations of ideas? Like, are you a kind of agonized writer of philosophy?
Yes, but this is encroaching on what I was going to say in answer to your next question.
Oh, okay. So we'll come back to this. Well, let me ask something else about just the one other thread that you raised that I find really interesting is the suggestion that this could be a kind of an impediment to doing one's own philosophical work. I remember one of the most vivid philosophical memories I have of graduate school was when I first arrived at grad school, there was a dissertation defense, and I thought, well, I should go and find out what a dissertation is supposed to look like. And I guess I had the idea that a philosopher was someone who qualified and complicated every thought, and that anytime anyone said anything, they saw 1,000 nuances. And what I remember is, I won't name who it was, but the person in question, I read their dissertation and someone asked them, well, your view is, you know, XYZ. And I knew that the view was a bit more complicated than that. And I thought, aha, they're going to point out all the subtle errors in this question. And instead they said, yes, because none of the complications were relevant yet. And then they waited. And I thought, oh my God, this was amazing. There was this sense of undefensiveness. I mean, so I think there's a real question about whether this sort of tendency to qualify and complicate things is empowering or inhibiting in one's own philosophical work. Could you say why, you know, say more about why you sort of think it's an impediment?
So I think it's an impediment because I think it's, if the qualifying involves changing your view on things, then it can be hard to maintain a view long enough to develop properly an argument for it if sort of halfway through you're changing your mind all the time. Yeah, it's not just overcomplicating. It's more often having a failure to arrive at a settled view.
I see. Yeah, no, that makes sense. So there's sort of two levels at which one can second guess. There's the second guessing that actually involves changing one's own view. And then there's a kind of defensiveness in communicating about philosophy that involves being unnecessarily fastidious about things. And those are sort of different kinds of tactics. Let's go to the second question then, which you've already started to anticipate. This is question two. Is there a trait you wish you had more of as a philosopher?
So I think this is quite closely related. I wish I was able to write more easily, and in particular, to write shorter pieces. I think there are two reasons why I find it difficult. One is to do with the aspect of temperament that we've just been discussing. So I find it quite hard to settle on a view and defend it without just changing my mind halfway through. And the other is that which I think probably is also related, is that I think I tend to think in book scale projects and in quite a holistic way. And that means that the things that I've done that I've really thought were more successful were things where it ended up being a book, and I didn't really think that any one bit of the book was very easily separable from the rest. And that just means that since it's a huge undertaking to do a book, that it's you don't have the satisfaction of producing small things along the way, that, or I don't easily have that satisfaction. I mean, I think one thing that's interesting about this, which actually is related to something you said earlier, is that I find I can suspend this second guessing and this not coming to a definite view when I'm giving a talk. So the one way I've managed to overcome this problem to the extent that I have has been by approaching writing by, first of all, giving a talk. And I find that if I'm giving a talk, because there I'm not just working out what I think, but I'm trying to communicate with an audience and I'm trying to tell them a story because I want it to be interesting for them and I want them to go away with something. And I think those pragmatic aspects, and also the fact that it's in real time, and so you, if you just kept changing your mind, you wouldn't communicate anything, and that it's got to be done at a certain time, you can't keep postponing it. Those things make it mean that I find it much easier for the first draft of anything I want to say to be a talk rather than a written version. And so when I do want to develop a paper of my own, it's usually easiest for me to do it by giving a talk first.
That's really interesting. I'm trying to map these sort of different styles or different relationships to philosophy onto ancient philosophers that you've worked on and thought about. I mean, I do sort of tend to associate Aristotle, partly, I suppose, because we have these lecture notes of his, with a kind of second guessing, qualifying intricacy, and Plato's dialogues with storytelling and kind of narrative. I mean, do you find yourself more attracted to Aristotle than Plato because of that sort of temperamental affinity?
Oh, that's very interesting. I don't think so. I mean, or at least that might be true of partly why I'm attracted to Aristotle. I don't think I would quite say that I would associate Plato with storytelling, because in a way, you might think the dialogue form is a way of not asserting things in your own voice. And so I think that Plato, too, often has this quality that you can see puzzles being worked through rather than a sort of sustained argument for a particular conclusion.
Right. No, that's true. Maybe I'll move on to question three and try and connect it with this in a certain way, because we've been talking about, in a way, the angst of philosophy, the second guessing and the intellectual self-criticism and the difficulty of settling. So question three is, what do you love most about philosophy?
So I think, funnily enough, what I love most about philosophy is the puzzles that don't get settled. So I'm much more attracted to the kind of philosophy that shows that something that you always thought was perfectly straightforward is in fact deeply puzzling, than to the kind of philosophy that takes something that philosophers think of as a puzzle and shows that actually it's not a puzzle after all. So I'm much more attracted to the kind of philosophy that creates puzzles than the kind of philosophy that solves puzzles. And again, I think that might be partly why I'm interested in history of philosophy, in the sense that it is a kind of oblique way of approaching these puzzles rather than head on trying to find answers to them. But there's something here I don't wholly understand about my own attitude to philosophy, because it's not just that I enjoy playing with the ideas. So I do think of myself as being, you know, orientated towards truth and, you know, trying to work out what's true or trying to arrive at understanding that's a kind of true understanding. But if I worked out on a philosophical question exactly what I thought and thought I properly understood what I was saying and had a view, I think I would cease to be interested in that philosophical question. So I don't really think of myself as it were, arriving at a view and then persuading others of it, because by the time I'd arrived at the view, I wouldn't really be very interested in persuading others of it.
That's really interesting. I mean, I wonder if this comes up when you're teaching, that the sort of finding of puzzles that may be difficult to resolve can seem perverse, or it's tempting to ask, well, why make things difficult? Do undergrads sometimes, when you're teaching them, respond with resistance or mystification to this philosophical enterprise?
Well, no, because I suppose, since I am in doing undergraduate teaching, I would be trying to solve, showing different ways in which one might try and solve puzzles, and most of them don't actually solve the fundamental puzzles. And I take that as being preserving the wonder of philosophy, preserving what's exciting about it. It doesn't seem to me that it's that philosophy is best thought of as arriving at a set of propositions that we can all sign up to. It seems to me to be more trying to understand the nature of these puzzles and what it is about our thinking that gives rise to these puzzles. And then in terms of history of philosophy, I suppose I'm especially interested in places where the kind of puzzles they asked weren't quite the same, but were in some way related to the puzzles that interest us and why that is.
But there is something sort of puzzling about the idea that what's attractive and gripping about philosophy is the puzzles, and that if they were dissipated, if the puzzles were just conclusively solved, the magic would go away. Because it gives you a perverse incentive, let's say, to try and keep the puzzle alive. And who wants to give up on the wonder of philosophy?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is possibly related to some of my problems with doing philosophy, in the sense that I think I do have a slight, I mean, it's not a genuine worry, is it, that in fact we might solve all the puzzles?
No, I guess so.
So, but on the other hand, I do sometimes think that I'm trying really, really hard to do something that if I was fully successful at it, would undermine the whole interest of what it is I'm trying to do. Right, would undermine one of the things I find most exciting in life would no longer be exciting if the project was successful. I mean, it's a little bit like, so in Aristotle, there's a distinction between a kind of activity that is a going towards some end state, a kinesis, and a kind of activity that isn't a progression towards some end state. And solving puzzles looks like it's the kind of activity that is a going towards some end state. And you might think that if you're engaged in that kind of activity, then you should want to be in the end state. And if the end state that we're sort of moving, that we're trying to get towards, is perfect understanding, I mean, of course, there's a sense in which that sounds glorious, but it does seem to sort of take away most of what I find of the joy of doing philosophy.
I totally resonate to that. There's a wonderful passage from the early modern philosopher Malebranche, who says, if I found the truth and captured it and held it in my hands, I would open them and let it go again so that I could pursue it once more. And that sort of expresses this sense that it would be kind of stasis to have found the final answer to questions when the joy is in thinking and learning about them. Well, maybe we'll end with that quandary, that particular question, and I'll ask you a question that I'm especially excited to ask a historian of philosophy. Question 4, what's the most important work of philosophy you have never read?
So there are actually plenty of important works of philosophy I've not read, but I think what you really want to know is what I'm most embarrassed about not
having read. Yes, of course, yes.
So the thing I'm most embarrassed about not having read is Augustine's Confessions. And the reason I'm embarrassed about not having read that is kind of obvious. He lived in the same time period as the Neoplatonists, who are the subject of my latest book. He was influenced by Platonist work. I mean, I have read the little bit on time. So he also read on time. So that's also related to my interests. And I really think I should read it. When I've tried to read it in the past, I've found it quite hard to get on with. And I think that's for a fairly superficial reason, but it's to do with the religiosity of it. And I think it's mainly to do with the fact that it's in the second person as a kind of address to God. And I just find that very off-putting. And I'm not quite sure why I find it so off-putting, because after all, I'm quite happy to read all these strange Neoplatonists who have odd views about the divine. I was not brought up with any particular religion, although as somebody going to mainstream schools in the UK, you get a kind of Christianity at school. But I wasn't brought up as a believer. But I don't have any sort of animus against religious belief, and I love a lot of religious music. So I don't quite know why I find it so off-putting. And part of my reason for telling you that that's the thing I've not read is that now I'll be so embarrassed that people are going to listen to this that I will go away.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting phenomenon, that you're confessing to a failure of the will and using external strategies to try and force yourself to overcome it, which is, you know, broadly Augustinian theme. I mean, I wonder if it's specifically the address. That was really interesting to me, that part of what is off-putting is that it's addressed to God. I mean, do you find it uncomfortable to be occupying the position of God in this particular conversation?
That's an interesting idea. I don't think I take it as addressed to me as God. I mean, that would be uncomfortable. But I think it feels like listening in to something that should be a private conversation.
I see. Yeah. Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah, yes. I will share your confession that I also have read bits. I've read about the pear tree in time, but I have not read Augustine's confessions from cover to cover. And so maybe now, having shared this confession, I will also be motivated to correct this. I'm going to move on to our final question, which I always end with from Iris Murdoch, beginning with another quote. "It's always a significant question to ask about any philosopher," she wrote. "What is she afraid of?" So what are you afraid of?
So I looked, in spite of having told you earlier on that I don't get on with Murdoch, I did look up this quote in Murdoch. And I think that, so the context is where she's talking about her own views about the good. And she's worrying about whether she's just really substituting for God the good, and whether that's because of some unconscious fear of hers. So I think that what she has in mind is the thought that we as philosophers might have some fear we're not really aware of, but that's influencing the way we do philosophy. And if that's right, obviously it's difficult to say for oneself what that fear would be. But I've had some thoughts just thinking actually over what we've been talking about to do with my temperament and so on. I mean, it occurs to me that what somebody might say, listening to all the stuff that I've been saying about second-guessing myself and thinking about the alternative point of view and so on, would be something like, well, maybe that's motivated by a kind of fear, a kind of fear to commit to some particular position and stick with it. And I mean, an obvious explanation for such a fear would be that you're afraid of being refuted. And you might think, well, maybe I do history of philosophy because I don't mind so much if the thing that I'm refuted on is, you know, what Aristotle thought about such and such, but I do mind if it's about some deep philosophical question. So I thought about that as a possible thing to say, and I don't like that interpretation of myself. But I suppose if one thinks of if one's trying to do this kind of self-psychoanalysis, the unconscious fear, if it's a real one, is not likely to be one that one's very willing to admit to. So, but I have been trying to think of arguments against that interpretation of me. Yeah. So one argument against is that it wouldn't make sense of the fact that I find it much easier to commit to views when I'm giving talks, which is, of course, exactly the case where you would be have somebody arguing against you or in the question period. So I don't mind committing to views in that. And it's when I'm writing in the privacy of my own room that I find it hard. So an alternative and more attractive unconscious fear that could be behind this sort of refusal to commit might be to do with my attitude to not wanting to get rid of the puzzle. So you could imagine maybe deep down I'm worried that if I did sort of successfully argue for some philosophical thesis and defend it and fully understand it, that I would have just removed all the interest from it, or all the stuff that I find interesting in it. So that if what I'm doing is a kind of progression towards an end point of full understanding without any questions left, and if I don't want to be at such an end point because it would remove the excitement of philosophy, then maybe I have a kind of fear of success in that progression. And that, even though, as we said before, it's not as if it's a real possibility to get to the end state, at least not in this life. The Neoplatonists thought one might do it outside this sort of temporal world. But I suppose that a fear doesn't have to be a rational fear of something that might realistically happen for it to be a kind of unconscious fear that could influence what you were doing.
I love that. Well, instead of the fear of being wrong, it's really the fear of being right that,
yes,
that
exactly.
Motivates you to second guess. Well, that's a perfect place to end the conversation, and for me to say thank you, Ursula, for appearing on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Kieran.
Ursula Coop is Professor of Ancient Philosophy at the University of Oxford. She's the author of Time for Aristotle, and freedom and responsibility in Neoplatonist thought. Thanks for listening to Five Questions.